This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For centuries, marriage functioned as a political, practical, and economic union, depending on your station in life. For the aristocrats, a good marriage secured fortunes and position. For common folk, it meant having enough kids to work a farm. It's only in the last 100 years or so that the idea of a passionate marriage took hold of the popular imagination. Today, most of us are less worried about basic survival and can focus more on what we desire in a union, usually a healthy, dynamic, secure relationship that is dependable, but not when it comes to sex, which people want to be anything but staid and predictable. Esther Perel has based her career on how to unite those conflicting desires. She's a psychologist, a sex therapist, and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. Her best-selling book is called Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence. And we spoke to her earlier this year.
Never before have we invested more in love as a part of marriage, as a constitutive part of marriage, and never have we divorced more in the name of the absence of that love. We have piled up expectations that we try to meet with one person to the extent that relationships sometimes crumble under the amount of expectations. We are asking one person to give us what we've always expected from long-term relationships or marriages: security, family life, companionship, social status, economic support. And we want that same person to also be our best friend and our trusted confidant and our passionate lover to boot. And we live twice as long. And that's a tall order for a party of two.
Yeah, that's an awful lot to put on a relationship. So there's this tension that a lot of couples have. What's driving that?
A few things are driving it, right? We are living in the West in a free world in which we have a market economy that doesn't just apply to finance, but also to romantic relationships, and in which the values of freedom and autonomy have become ultimate. We have today this concept of a passionate marriage, which used to be a contradiction in terms. Marriage was here and passion pretty much a privilege mostly for men that could experience it with far more safety than women, for whom the consequences were dire. And we want today one person and one relationship to give us two fundamental sets of human needs that are actually rather opposite and that spring from different sources and pull us in different directions, which is our need for security and our need for adventure. Or in systemic language, our need for stability and our need for growth and change. This is the first time in the history of humankind where we have sex not because we want multiple children or because it's exclusively a woman's marital duty. We want sex that is rooted in desire, that is the sovereign expression of our free will. I want it.
So how do you keep that desire alive when you have kids and a job and you're exhausted and you've made dinner and done dishes and get the kids bathed and negotiate all of these different responsibilities that stifle eroticism?
Or one could say they may not necessarily stifle the erotic, but they displace it. If you look at many modern families, I would say that often the erotic energy is alive and well. But for that, you have to think of eroticism not as sex and the narrow meaning that we have attributed to the erotic. If you think about novelty, imagination, playfulness, curiosity, mystery, as essential erotic ingredients, they are all present in a family with children, but it's often eros redirected. The kids get novel activities and the couple does the same old, same old. The question then becomes, how do people bring some of that energy back to the couple, and why does it matter? It matters because for most couples in the West today, the survival of the family depends on the reasonable contentment of the couple. So on the long list of what your children need, a couple that has an erotic bond should feature as one of the main items.
It sounds to me like that's about intimacy. That's about living a life together. But you write that intimacy doesn't necessarily mean good sex. And I'd love to hear more about that, because current thinking tells us that the two are intrinsically combined. I mean, it sounds like what couples therapists say to keep people together.
Yes. For me, intimacy, first of all, is a concept that has profoundly changed its meaning. It used to be a convivencia, a living together, a sharing of the daily, a raising of the children, a working of the land, attachment and habit. Intimacy today is a deep experience of recognition of my individuality, of my authentic self, for which you are going to be a validating, reflective listener that's going to help me transcend my existential aloneness. That is a very different kind of intimacy. Now, its connection to sexuality is highly questioned. If mutuality and reciprocity and protection and worry about the well-being of our partner and a sense of responsibility are part of the experience of love, then sometimes the very experience of responsibility, worry, and protection can be sexually deflating.
Your concept of intimacy also involves an idea of privacy. So tell us a little bit about this idea of personal intimacy.
Personal intimacy is the experience of interiority, of an inner world with oneself. What's interesting is that we live in the age of transparency, in which the same concept of intimacy has become equated with transparent, with wholesale sharing. We are close because we can tell each other everything, rather than we are close maybe because we don't have to tell each other everything, because we know that we have worlds and parts of us that remain personal and private.
We're speaking with the psychologist and author Esther Perel about how to keep long-term relationships fresh, let's say, and healthy. Esther, you talked about the importance of personal intimacy, but what about using that concept as a right to unmitigated privacy or a justification for having an affair? Are you saying in some cases that infidelity can be okay?
Look, the question of what is separate and what is together is a fundamental question that belongs to the making of any couple. Every couple decides what is separate and what is common, what thoughts need to be shared, what finances need to be shared, what fantasies can need to be shared, and what remains personal, what friends can remain your own and what friends have to be joined, what movies you can see on your own, or if you have to see only the movies that both of us want to see. This is an organizing principle of any intimate relationship. The difference between heterosexual couples maybe and homosexual couples is that in straight couples, there is an assumption that is made up front so that the question is rarely negotiated, certainly not in the sexual realm, because that threatens the sacred ideal of the romantic myth. What you're asking me is to take something that is a lot more ambiguous and a lot more complex and make determinations that have never been able to be made.
Let's talk about something a little more concrete that you found from people when you traveled around the world on your book tour and asked people, when do you find yourself most drawn to your partner? I'm interested to hear what you found.
You know, it's a question that I originally asked. I've asked it in about 22 countries. Mating in Captivity is translated in about 25 languages. And I thought there must be major cultural differences. And except for one answer that is gender-based, which is when the women say, when I see him playing with the children, which is very sexy and not the other way around, none of the answers are gender-bound. They cross back and forth. But they basically organize themselves in four groups of answers. One would be when I am separated from my partner, when he or she is away, when we reunite, highlighting the notion that desire also is rooted in absence and in longing. So that's the first group of answers, which we could elaborate. The second one was when I see my partner doing something that he or she is competent about, passionate about, in their element, self-sufficient. Basically, when I see my partner as an other, separate from me, that I do not need to take care of. And that experience of a radiant other, where there is no caretaking and no sense of responsibility, is highly charged with attraction, with desire, with admiration, which is an essential element of desire. The third group was when he or she or I, when we surprise each other, highlighting the notion of novelty, of breaking of routine, of the eruption of desire. And surprise could be going and doing something that's different from the usual, or seeing my partner as vulnerable, not because vulnerability is so attractive, but because I don't typically get to see my partner in that space. And then the other one was when we're on vacation, when the kids are not there, basically highlighting the playfulness, the open-endedness, the non-productive nature of erotic sex, meaning sexuality that is transformed by our imagination, or the poetics of sex, basically. So these groups began to highlight that you look at this person that's already so familiar, and momentarily they are once again somewhat mysterious, somewhat unknown, somewhat elusive. And in that space between me and the other lies the erotic elan.
Mm. So, Esther Perel, with those things in mind, does a perfect marriage exist, or what does a really great marriage look like to you?
When I went around and asked, it's not about separate people living separate life at all, but it is about people who have a fundamental respect for the freedom, the existential freedom of another person. That is not the freedom to cheat and all of that, but basically the sense that you don't confuse intimacy with surveillance, and you don't confuse intimacy with fusion. It is a relationship where two people are able to continue to grow. You know, we used to die 7 years after we were done raising our kids. Today we have this phase where we say, is this it? And that thirst for feeling alive, which means that there is still surprise to come, that new things can still emerge, new experience we haven't known, that is what keeps us on the edge of our seats. It is the difference between not being dead and being alive. And I think that a thriving relationship very much focuses on that distinction.
Well, thank you for all of the surprises and inspiration today, Esther Perel. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Esther Perel, a psychotherapist and author who specializes in couples and sexuality. You can find more on her best-selling book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence, or a link to watch her TED Talk and much more at wordofmouthradio.org.
My funny Valentine.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Earlier in the show, we talked with social psychologist Spike Lee about the concept of true love and why placing a romantic partner on the soulmate pedestal could be damaging to a relationship.
What it highlights is the idea of perfect harmony. Now, perfect harmony means that you shouldn't really have any conflicts. If you had conflicts, it basically suggests that, well, we weren't really made for each other.
Perhaps you are among the 73% of Americans who believe in the concept of a soulmate. If so, Dr. Raymond Nee has developed a test to determine where individuals fall on the soulmate scale. You can take the test for yourself. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. So glad to have you with us. And we will be back with more Word of Mouth Sunday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Don't change your hair for me, not if you care.